listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by API. Now from the Nowcast Network Studios, here's Mike.
Hey, welcome to the Audio Nowcast. My name is Mike Rodriguez. And before we get going, let me introduce the guys. Over here on my right, we've got Martin Page. Welcome, Martin.
It's nice to be here at Christmas, Mike.
That's right. And next to him, we've got... Oh my goodness, two in a row, Scott Gershon. Scott.
Hello, Mike!
And joining me over here, on my left-hand side, we've got Bobby Osinski.
Good evening, Mike.
And finally, we've got all the way from Austin, Texas.
Kind of like Max Headroom, you know?
That's right. I don't even know if he really exists in real life, because I haven't seen him in months.
That's true.
It's a digital interpretation.
Right.
It's an AI program, AI app.
The one and only Rob Arbiter.
127 in a row, Mike, right?
That's right.
Wow.
127 wow. in a row.
That is legendary.
But
that is.
You know what? But I don't know if that's actually Rob or his avatar. So.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
We'll have to wait.
A little bit of both.
but how's things out in Texas?
Well, things so far seem pretty good. I've been here about a half hour, but it's looking nice so far. It's sort of a cold evening.
That's right, because you just flew in, right?
I just flew in moments ago.
So you missed L.A. because lately it feels like it's in Minnesota.
That's what I hear. Well, yeah, I haven't been in L.A. since it was very, very warm in the summer. It's been a few months.
So are your arms tired?
Ba-doom-tsh.
All right.
Exhausted.
Well, guys, this is show number 127, as Rob said, and this is going to be the last one for the year. And it's been an interesting year. Let's wait till the end for that. But I will say, you know what? The listeners, you guys are out there and we are holding steady. Actually, we have more downloads this year than any year. We've done the least amount of shows, but we've had more downloads. Wow. So it's been
quality.
Pretty amazing.
Quality. It's
pretty
not size,
amazing.
Is it, or amount. It's quality.
Yep. Wow. And we're not, you know what, guys? We're not abandoning you. It's just that everybody's been really busy, and it's been kind of sporadic. And there was one show that had technical difficulties.
Yeah, the one you tried to do without me.
That's right.
It can't be done.
But just know that we're still moving strong and have some great plans for next year. But we're just going to start right off the bat. Really quick, before I get into anything, I was in a really great conversation with a friend of mine. And every once in a while, I get in conversations and I actually get to say things that make me seem smart. And I actually get to reference individuals that make me feel smart. And I got to reference Bobby Osinski's blog and this conversation that I was having with a friend of mine on where do you find music and how do you find music. And they were talking about the whole Facebook and whether or not you are even interested in what people are playing right now, because you know there's some services out there where it shows what's playing and how that's annoying and things like that. And I on Bobby Osinski's blog, he was mentioning that Spotify basically did an about face on how they use social networking for music discovery, right?
Yes, so coming out with a new version, a new user interface. And instead of where before, they relied on other people, on your friends, for instance, to tell you what they're listening to, thinking that that would allow you to find new music. And it turns out that that's not the way it works. Because most of the time, your good friends don't have the same taste as you, which they found, after a couple years that that's the case. So they did an about face. So and what they're doing now is they're using basically curated talent. So it's just going back to the old days of the DJ, when the FM DJ, when you listen because you love the taste of the DJ. So it's the same, only now we brought it into 2013. Yeah, it just goes to show you where everything comes around goes around.
And you know what was the best thing about the whole conversation? I got to use the line, well, my friend Bobby Osinski made me seem like a genius. But I thought it was really interesting in that.
And he knew what you were talking about.
I thought it was really interesting in the fact that There's nothing more annoying than seeing people's, you know, what they're listening to pop up on your Facebook stream. You know, I mean, that's really annoying. But, you know, I find friends, you know, you can compartmentalize your friends. And there's certain friends that are very influential in my music choices, you know. Mm-hmm. There's, like, for instance, Martin. You know, Martin has exposed me to a ton of really good music. And because he's always reading and you're always, you know, you're always – looking on the net and seeing what's out there. And so Martin and I've got a couple other friends that I totally would trust with music. But then there's those other friends that you're probably good friends because you get in that sparring, you know, those musical conversations where it's like, this is better than that and that sucks and things like that. And you have nothing in common with those friends.
Do you think less of them for what they're listening to?
No, that's the third group. The second group, you actually – I have friends that they'll, you know, they'll mention their musical taste and things like that. And it's eons away. But, you know, I don't mind getting into little, you know, sparring matches, especially the ones that are really into country and, you know – and even, like, I'm not a huge fan of, like, rap and things like that. And I have some friends that are really into urban music and things like that. So there's that category. And then there's the category of friends that you just – you shake your head, you say why, and you, like – you do feel a little less about them because of their musical choices. So I think if Spotify could somehow figure that whole thing out, because I don't think it's that social is necessarily totally bad for musical tastes, but I think it's your friends are definitely compartmentalized.
But
I
mean, again, it's your trusted influence.
Yeah, that's true.
And Barton is your trusted influence right there. And it could be Pitchfork for some people, for instance. It could be just, you know, think of anybody that's influential on the web. Yeah.
So I always rely on Rob to let me know the coolest Rush album that just may have come out.
Because Rob's so much into prog music.
There's no such thing. By the way, I will mention, if you go back and look 70 or 80 podcasts ago, I said that the whole friend recommendation thing was going to be supplanted by tastemakers coming back. Because I felt that for a really long time.
Yeah.
People like being told what's good. And a lot of times that's only going to come from someone who spends their whole life trying to figure out what's good. And if that person has the same taste as you, that's always going to be a better referral than a friend.
That's why we used to read record reviews.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
And also, like, I remember, you know, when I was really young, was it Toad out of New York or KDKB? I remember it was a radio station. I remember, and it wasn't as commercialized. It was like late at night, some guy would come on, hey, it's Toad, you know, and then he would say, like, hey, here's an album. I don't know if you guys would like Blanc.
You know, in England, in my era, it was John Peel. You know, John Peel was so influential at that time. And he was a DJ for Radio 1, and he was notorious for picking on the sort of independent bands that were just coming through, like T-Rex, early Jethro Tull.
Yeah.
And Bowie. And everybody really found him to be a huge influence. And you sort of – what was great about that is he was underground, and everybody liked the feeling of that. Right. Underground that was going to go pop. Right. Down the line. And so it's great, you know, what Bobby was saying, that you find these people that are as interesting to you as the bands. You know, you're interested in the way they talk, the way they're thinking about music and what they've been involved with. So I think that's interesting.
Has anybody been watching the Jules Holland Show by any chance?
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
Which, again, have you watched that?
No, what is it?
He has a new show. It's on the High Def concert channel, Palladia.
Yeah.
And he has five acts on. They're in the round. And he goes from one to the other. And he may have Metallica on, but he'll have four other acts. And he'll have an A list, he'll have a B list, and he'll have three other acts that you've never heard of. Hmm. And they're all really good and really interesting and really wide, different genres. Yeah. It's fantastic.
I'll have to check that out.
Yes, it's... It's kind of like a new version of, again, the FM radio that we grew up on.
You know, that's interesting. Really, that's what we're striving for, is that little voice that tells you, that introduces you to music and tells you this is good because of this. Although I will want to caution that, you know, don't believe everything you read. There's a certain amount of anonymity that you know writers can hide behind on the internet and basically tell you stuff that's not necessarily true. Because Martin, we were talking about, there was some guy who was trying to explain one of your songs.
Yeah.
And it was
that's a website, I think, that I think it's called Story Behind the Music or whatever, and this website does all the, you know, American right. Pie, all the songs that are a little bit confusing to everybody. And it's interesting because you see what this guy says about Penny Lane, and then he wrote about my song In the House of Stone and Light. And some of it's on and some of it's way off, way off. But, you know, again, getting back to what Bobby was saying there, one of the interesting things I want to bring up is that Jewel Holland's show is live musicians.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's a big thing.
Right.
I think that's almost hip now, because in my era, it was the old Grey Whistle Test.
Yeah, right, exactly.
And we used to tune into that on BBC Two, which again was a sort of independent label, and we would independent program, and we would see Bob Marley and the Wailers and a Squeeze, and they would after that become very hip.
Yeah,
and again,
Tom Petty over there.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah. And it was live music, and I think what we're talking about here is what's quite unusual.
Right.
The sound is great too on Jules Holland. Yeah. The mix is terrific.
Yeah,
is that a normal cable? Because I don't know if I've got that.
You have to have the HD package because it's HD only. Yeah.
Well, you know, but I think. You know, the BBC and over in England, they've always been kind of ahead of the times, and they're different in Europe in general in their music shows. Because I remember when I was touring with Stevie Wonder, we played a bunch of those music shows like The White Room, and there was another big one over in France.
Well, what can we watch on American TV now, which is a live band playing? I know there's
a lot of singers.
Don Was has that new show on Saturday night.
Okay.
And it's sort of like a contest. There's three acts
I've seen that once.
Yeah.
But, you know, again, back in my era, it was Don Kirshner's rock concert.
Don Kirshner's, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Used to be late at night. And I saw Genesis on there back then for the first time.
Well, you know what gets a lot of bands, too, is the late night shows, like David Letterman,
sure,
Jimmy Kimmel.
Right. Yeah.
Really, that's
but
kind of on the circuit.
But it's thin, though. You know, it's like... even when I was breaking with, it was hard to get on those shows.
Right.
You know, what are you doing, Rob? Are you playing with your teeth or something?
Are you eating Tic Tacs?
You taking your teeth out again?
Making noise.
But in the old Grey Whistle Test, you'd see 10 bands in a night. And so it was really eclectic. Right. And a big turn on. And actually, when you think about now, everybody looking at the internet and just getting people saying, this is a good record, it was so great back then to see a band having to perform live. And I think that's actually quite hip now, the bands actually
good,
playing.
Good.
Yeah,
it better be good.
I also think that even though it's very, very commercial, but some of the reality music shows, like The Voice, that has some very talented singers... But they're not
artists, though. They're singers.
No. But what it's doing, it's taking a generation of people that are getting used to – because eventually, after The Voice, if they like them, they're going to go off and do something. And then, you know, the band then is good because the band's playing live.
I mean, American Idol with Kelly Clarkson. I mean, that's you know
– But even I think American Idol's – just I don't know. I think it's a little more formulaic and you meet people and they're like, oh, they're not too bad. And when you hear The Voice, it's like, first of all, a lot of them, especially this year, were background singers for major people.
Were they really?
Yeah, like Lady Gaga's background singer and all these people that are going, hey, you know what? I've been on the road. I've been professional. I've been doing this. What a great way to get exposure. So they go on. They've got chops. And one of the things I think that for me that's different between Idol and The Voice is, first of all, Idol, everybody goes to that high note. So it's very, to me, very formulaic.
Right.
And The Voice, it couldn't be, you've got like a Ricky Lee Jones sound alike. You've got a very husky voice. You've got a pop voice. You got a rock. And they're all very different. And they're all, the quality of vocalists are really good just from the get-go. So it's interesting to see where they progress to. And there's a certain entertainment value. But more than that, I think, though, it's just seeing people, even though it's TV, doing something live, which makes people get more used to than, you know, just albums only.
You know, Daryl Hall's show, too. Yes, that's the other
true.
One.
Yeah, that's very true.
Which came from the internet. That was internet only.
Oh, was it?
Yes, right, for a couple of years.
Wow.
I just think, you know, that's going to be the big key, the one that can be the influence maker. And especially if anybody can monetize that they'll win.
On one hand, I think that it's great that the internet has allowed so many people to have distribution. And, you know, whether it's good or bad is definitely, you know, a taste and it's relative.
It's true.
But the problem we've all run into within your different genres is now there's too much information. So now for the average person, it's just noise. Mm-hmm. So now if somebody could say, hey, I trust this person, like you're saying, had similar tastes, what should I listen to?
Yeah.
And then they just start opening doors. I remember when I first started hearing, you know, Pink Floyd and Yes. And all the prog bands, I guess, Genesis. But then we were like, oh, look what we just found.
Sure, yeah.
This was cool.
But the good thing is that, you know what? The internet gives anybody a voice. And if they want to rally behind an artist that they really like Wang Chung, for instance.
Well, what about the guy from Korea, the sensation?
Who also has a new album, Taser Up by Wang Chung. Which you tonight, should get because it's actually really good. Right?
It is. It's a very good record.
It's a great record.
Yeah.
I'll have to say Wang Chung a few more times because that really is a good record. But you know, it allows people to create their own, you know, grassroots effort to help push the album. And anyhow, I just thought that was really interesting. And
I think it's fascinating that Spotify want to change the method.
But you know what's interesting? People find – I've read a lot of studies on this. People still discover most of their music on radio.
Yeah.
That's number one. Hmm. Number two is YouTube. Number three is Pandora.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
I can see Pandora because you accidentally run across something, you know? And I have Spotify and I've got the premium, I got the download and all that. And I still listen to Pandora when I just want to go into that, you know, that random, let's just see what happens. Let's just see what they're going to throw. Even I could do the same thing on Spotify. They have different, radio stations and stuff. I'm just so used to that. The Pandora, like, okay, let's just take me on a ride, you know? And usually they're pretty good, you know, with how they select their music. That's a whole science in and of itself, is how they select the relationship between the different artists. If you want to listen to one type of music, and they're really good about staying close to that.
Rob, do you know anything about that? How that's done?
No, I don't. I mean, I know it's a sophisticated. The brass ring for any of these technologies is the categorization, and you know how. Just to use sort of layman's terms, just how much data they store for each artist to differentiate them. So it's not, you know, like a really primitive way to do it would be to say this is a country guy, this is a rock guy, this is a rap guy. But they break it down into very tiny slivers of information. And the more slivers, the better you can differentiate one artist from another.
But probably it goes both ways, because it's the artist and it's also the listener too.
Yeah.
Right, but what they can do is they can break it down in as much as this artist mostly does songs in major keys, and this artist mostly does songs in this tempo range. And, you know, if you really categorize every song by an artist and things about the artist themselves, you start to build almost like a blueprint, a digital blueprint of that artist's track history. And you can start to compare those blueprints, but the granularity of the information, which is what it's called, you know, how small a little pieces you have for each artist and how many of them, that makes the searching smarter and smarter. And it's not just done for artists. It's done in all kinds of different technologies. But, that's what – it's the same kind of idea about how something like Shazam would work.
Right.
Yeah. You know, where they're capturing little slivers of things. You can do the same by categorizing an artist. I think Pandora and Spotify have very different ways of categorizing the music.
Do they do it automated, or is it a listener that enters data entry?
There's a lot of data entry as well. Some of it's automatic, but some of it is data entry. And I think that Pandora has always had a leg up on sort of the intelligence side of things, whereas Spotify has always been more like a traditional search engine on the inside. Personally, I find Spotify to not be a great search engine. It'll return a lot of results that you're not looking for. It'll return a lot of versions of songs that are not the ones you're looking for.
That's true.
So there's still a lot to be done to improve all that.
There's a ton of karaoke that you'll find on Spotify.
Yeah, that's a problem when you see we have 18 million songs. Yeah, but there's only 2 million of them that you want to
– That's right.
Which is still – way too much, but
my problem is also they know which is the real official release version of a song. I don't know why they return so many crap results that have nothing to do with what you're looking for. You know, they know if you look up a certain song, and Bobby Somerville and I have wasted many, many hours just playing around with this, and I'm sure Martin has with him too. But you know, you'll search for, you want to find some classic song from the 70s or 80s or something, and the first giant list of results it returns are karaoke versions and sound-alikes and you know, just other bands you never heard of doing a cover of the song. It's like, no. If I'm looking for, I think Groove Line was one of them by Heatwave.
Yeah.
We were trying to, must have found 50 other things that weren't Groove Line.
Right.
You know, and in the time it took to finally find it, I could have run back to my house and brought the 45 back, which I do have.
Good for you. Good for you, my man.
I mean, I know my 9-year-old son, he just loves going to iTunes
and
just searches and searches. Like, and it's just huge discovery for him.
Yeah. Well, all this to say, you know, getting back to the whole, you know, where you listen and who influences your music, it's just really amazing how it's changing, and yet everybody's kind of still looking for the same DJ, the same figure, the same voice of authority that's going to.
The medium has changed, but the actual.
Yeah, I mean, music, I think, defines each generation, and each generation has their music. That's a little bit what the parents don't want them to listen to, perhaps,
right.
And something that just defines a generation getting out of the house that has to create their own identity.
You know what else? Computers can make an amazing educated guess at what you might like, but we're a long way from computers having taste.
That's true.
There's a big difference between making an educated guess based on data and taste.
Let me
ask. Because taste requires a leap of faith. The machine just isn't going to make the same way human would.
Let me ask you, Martin, where do you get your information for your new music? Because you're always finding some really interesting people every now and then.
That's a good question.
And it seems to me, and then I'll let you answer, that print plays a big part of it.
It does. I buy a lot of magazines, and I read a lot.
So you're the one.
I'm the only one, probably. Yeah, keeping paper alive, those poor trees. But I read right across the board from still, you know, like New Musical Express from England, but then I'll read the BBC Classical magazine as well because I love a lot of Taverner stuff and a lot of the choral work that I don't know about and avant-garde work as well. And I get a little teeny bit from, I would say, iTunes because I go on every now and then and I look at not necessarily what's in the charts, but if I'm interested in possibly a record from the past or even a classical record, I'll go looking for. And then, as you know, it'll lead you on. And as Bobby says, I think YouTube is really quite fascinating because you're watching something that you're interested in, maybe an early Bowie video or something from Top of the Pops, and down the side of the screen is everything else that seems to be closely linked to it. And then you go, oh! T-Rex, and you go, oh. And
down
then
that rabbit hole, yeah.
Yeah, and so I really find it from that place. I think for me personally, because I don't listen to radio a great deal, I might be listening. I go to, I'm a Amoeba. I go to buy a ton of CDs, and I walk from folk through to reggae, through to prog, through to the classical. And I basically know the artists I'm interested in. And then I start to purchase that and go, this is a great record. I'd like more of this. That's the way I basically work. It used to be, again, as Bobby says, all radio. It used to be to me FM radio. And late night radio in England, again, I go back to my childhood, it was Radio Luxembourg. Because we knew we were hearing things from a pirate station. Yeah. And we were hearing records that possibly Radio 1 wasn't about to play for some reason. and possibly they were a little ahead of the time. So, and again, as Scott says, you know, when you're younger, you want to be a little bit on the cusp. So you are listening to Radio Luxembourg and feeling quite hip again, you know. But that's how I pick it up now more. And I'm still a CD and a vinyl buyer. So I tend to want to go to Amoeba. And sometimes I'll just, you know, I'll look for, interestingly enough, I'll go, I don't know too much about krautrock. And I'd like to learn more about Cluster and Can and a lot of these bands. And then I buy something possibly by Cluster and go, maybe I should check out Eno. I've never really been a fan of that, but I know he got involved and maybe he made a special record. And I'll buy DVDs on classic music and then just there'll be lots of little hints from that. That's how I sort of move. It's a bit of – it's eclectic and it's from all the areas. And of course, I read a tremendous amount of books. And so even when you're reading a great book about, again, you know, Bowie or something, right. You start to go, you find out about his influences. And you've only got to go onto YouTube to watch something. And then you'll see another, a modern band that might be close to that. So I think YouTube is also very, that's like a radio station in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Well, I will say this, YouTube is doing everything it can to destroy its viewership. The way they're dealing with ads now.
Oh, I know. Yeah, yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Do you know now on YouTube, if you even scroll through a video, after a certain amount of scrolling through, they'll play you an ad. So even if you're on a single video right. and jumping around in it, you'll see ads in the middle of that video. They're going to destroy themselves.
Oh, yeah. It's the ads on all the video, not even just YouTube, but Yahoo
Vivo or any
of that. Yeah. You can't. It's worse than TV.
Yeah,
people were like,
"It's not a model that's going to last." Though I'm telling you, someone's going to figure out a way to not do that, and they're going to win because it's destroying that as the sort of free for all that everybody loves it for.
Sure,
but you know what? It's as long as they're making money, man. That's and there's huge numbers in online video ads. There's huge numbers.
But there's ways to do it more elegantly than is being done right now. There's a whole undercurrent of new people thinking differently about that because it's becoming – there's just too many obstacles to watching a video now. I mean, you go to even CNN.com, you'll see way more commercials on the website than you would on the network, and that's not going to last. People aren't going to put up with that forever once there's an alternative.
That's true. Yeah.
Mark my words, 70 podcasts from now.
you are the futurist.
Again, though, you know, I think Rob's saying that FM radio had hardly any ads, and yet AM radio did. And so that became hip to us as well, you know, and Radio Luxembourg was just playing record after record. Yeah. And they were telling you who the artists were. And that's a big deal to the youth.
But yeah, don't you think, like, you know, I remember back when, there was rock. Then it became corporate rock. So everyone got away from that. Then they went to punk.
Sure.
And then punk got kind of commercial. And then they went to heavy metal. And then heavy metal got corporate. And then everyone went to Seattle rock.
Right.
And then rap. Grunge.
So it seemed grunge. And then it seems like everybody wants to buck the trend. So right now, especially the more corporate, the more organized, the more thought out something is, the next gen of people want to go, we got to do a different way.
But isn't that the evolution of things where you start out as bucking the trend and you become the trend and next thing you know, you're past the trend.
Yeah. I mean, look at R.E.M., which was like alternative music, and now it's elevator music.
Look at Denim.
I mean, that's okay. Dio, you know.
But, anyhow, all this to say is it's a real – did you want to say something, by the way? You had started something earlier. I just think it's a really interesting time that we're living in, and even something as simple as how we get our music and who influences us is under a tremendous amount of change. And I'm telling you this because I'm going to segue into our next topic that we're going to talk about, and that is, you know, there's a few times in our lives where we have paradigm changes, where things change big time. And if you've been in music in the last, 30 years or so, you've seen it happen, right? I mean, for me personally, the paradigm, the big one that kind of started it for me was MIDI, when MIDI was first introduced. I mean, before MIDI, you had, CV, control voltages, and things could talk together. But really, music started to flourish once the MIDI standard was developed, and that happened. And then the next one would be like digital audio was the next big big paradigm shift where you had, you know, the early version of Pro Tools, which was Pro Edit and Pro Mix, and then Elisa's ADATs. And I'm sure everybody here worked with an ADAT and then things like that. Well,
sorry to say.
But it was, you know, that was kind of a game changer. That was a big shift.
And then plugins.
Yeah. And that's
huge.
Exactly. And that came along the whole digital audio workstation. Well, right now we're in the middle of another one, and it's kind of two things happening at the same time. And you know what we're going to do? I'm looking at my watch. We're going to take a break right now, and when we come back, we're going to talk about this next change, and it's going to lead into our discussion of the year.
So does this mean you're going to change your clothes too?
So we'll take a break, and we'll come back on the other side. I'll pick up this thought.
You're listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by API and Westwave Audio. Have a question for the panel? Would you like to be a guest on the Audio Nowcast and live in the LA area? Email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com.
Hey, welcome back to the Audio Nowcast. And before the break, I actually tried to tease the second half. Did you notice that? See how I built that up and then took a little break in the middle?
Very skillful.
Look at that. You know, after almost 7 years, I'm learning how to tease. Anyhow, we were talking about paradigm shifts and the different ones with MIDI and digital audio. Mm-hmm. There's one happening right now that we're all living through that is going to be huge. And that is
dun, dun, dun.
The music making capabilities on personal tablets and phones. It's really taken off with the introduction.
I like the tablets. The phones, I'm not quite sure about.
Right, but it's going to be something that's available. But AudioBus, I don't know if anybody around here knows what AudioBus is, but it's basically a $10 program that you buy for your iPad where you can link your effects, your sequencers, and your virtual instruments together. And it works really well.
Multiple iPads?
No, one iPad. Oh. So you can run several different programs. It's
AudioBus.
Oh, it's multitasking. Yes. Okay.
Yes.
Right.
It's phenomenal. I recently picked that up, and you can run a sequencer, an effects unit, and basically one or two synths along with it. And it's amazing how it all works, provided that the synthesizer supports it. And it works really well. And it's so amazing to see how these little things are popping up. I remember being amazed that I could sit in a coffee house and sound design and mix, you know, a TV commercial. I've told you about this on the podcast several times. Now the fact that I could sit in a coffee house with an iPad and do the same thing is truly, truly amazing.
And you have a studio that they just put how much money into?
Well, wouldn't it be cool though if there was a program that would link 3, 4, 5.
Well, you can. You can already. Together? You absolutely can already. You already can sync them together. Cork has a protocol that you can enable, and you can sync all their stuff together wirelessly. It's amazing, and it's but AudioBus is so cool because you're sending audio in and out, and it's really. I mean, when
is
I got
latency?
The program. No, but it's depending on how powerful your machine is. Like, I'm sure – I only have an iPad 2 equivalent. I got the iPad mini. But I'm sure on, like, an iPad 3, which has the more robust processor, you can probably run more stuff. But, no, it was really, really cool. Minimal latency, but not anything that would prevent you from doing music. And it's so – I mean, I can't tell you how big of a deal this is, because even though it's in its infant state right now – this is going much like MIDI. I mean, MIDI started off as, you know, working on a Commodore 64 with the first sequencers, and then you go all the way to, you know, what we have nowadays. And you look at right now how it's just starting to talk to each other. There's some exciting things that are happening.
You know what? I'm still not convinced about the touchscreen.
That's fine.
This is just a personal observation. I mean, the touchscreen for me, even on the iPad, and we'll just talk about anything other than audio, really flummoxes me sometimes. It's like, wait a second, I try to do that. Why is it doing that instead? you know, where you think you're clicking on something, or you're clicking on something else. Yeah. You're selecting something. You're selecting something. I mean, that really bugs me. And I got to say, on the the Aria, which is a wonderful workstation and everything, it bugs me. The resolution bothers me.
Right, and I think things like that, hardware things, are basically they're generational problems that get solved as we go along more and more generations. For instance, I got the Jot Touch pen that I use with my iPad Mini, and it works perfect. So like stuff that I used to do with just my finger, I use a stylus now, and it works great. And it just gives me a little bit more of accuracy in doing that. But what's so exciting, and the reason why I even wanted to bring this up, is if you can catch a wave, if you can – like I caught the MIDI wave, and I rode that to a career, to my profession, really. I mean, as MIDI got more mature and I learned all the programs and the protocols, boom, 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 and you get a keyboard gig, attack here, boom, boom, boom. You got to – you know, there's other guys that came in with the digital audio revolution. They learn the DAW. They learn Pro Tools, and they go and they flip that into a career. You know, you hop on this tablet thing, you just never know where that could lead you, you know? It seems, how are you going to make a career out of, you know, making music on a tablet? Well, you know, if you would have told me how, you know, 20 years ago, how I was going to make a career, you know, doing music on computers, that would have seemed just as absurd, you know? So you just – it's a time that if you're out there, you know, and you want to – and if you're young enough and you really want to plug into getting a career in music and technology and things like that, this is one of those waves that you can ride. Learn about this stuff. It's not expensive. That's what's so amazing about this time is gear is getting better and it's getting cheaper. And if you take the time and invest a little bit of money, you know, this is where your careers are going to come from. I don't know what they're going to be, but they'll be there.
I think when I look at the tablets as such, I'm not as much interested in those apps that are trying to emulate something you know. Like, hey, look, a little piano on a, at that point, get a piano. But what I am very intrigued with on the tablet concept is like the early ideas of a chaos pad, where all of a sudden, let's use what tablets are really good at, and let's build technology that's something different, rather than trying to model and emulate something that you already know as a triggerable device. What I love is being able to multi finger touch. Different elements that can help me morph a sound or manipulate it in a way that, just something that basically takes you to another level from sound design, whether it's musical or sound effects driven. All of a sudden, it allows you to interface with technology in a way that will give you a unique approach to a sound.
Well, what it's going to do is it creates emotional ties between you and the piece of gear and your sound. I mean, it basically streamlines your brain to the sound. I mean, especially with touch, you know, if the more
and multi-finger touch, right, which is really
the more you can manipulate at one time.
Can an iPad do that?
Yes. Oh, it's
so every finger can do something a little bit different, and all of a sudden that just becomes interesting.
Yeah.
That's why for me, the tablet's kind of neat and it's a little trivial, but all of a sudden you get two or three of those things in and your hands are doing different things and it becomes a new interface structure where you can create different forms of music that's a little bit out of the paradigm. I mean, even as silly, like I had a very early of something called a Hotz translator, and it was a whole bunch of pads. Now, what was really interesting about this pad structure, and it was basically pressure sensitive, there was no excursion on the pad. So I didn't have to wait for the keyboard to go down and go back up. So I could tap it super fast and I could move it, and it was 128 pads. All, and you can move it around. It was something that was years ago and Atari came out with it. A guy named Jimmy Hotz created it. He created it originally for McFleetwood, and he built a vest for him. And he could actually play.
Oh, I remember that. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So what he did was he stretched it out on a piece of metal, and you can play it. Now, all of a sudden, I was doing things that I couldn't do on a keyboard because the speed, just the mechanicalness of the keyboard, wouldn't support it. So all of a sudden, that did something. So that took up technology that, hate to say, we did it 15, 20 years ago.
Right.
The other thing that's interesting also is Kinect. for Microsoft and being able to utilize visual information to be able to control whether it's Apple or music. That's another interface that is yet to be utilized in a different way.
I just want to talk about the tablet because, you know.
Yeah, yeah, it's changed the conversation. I mean,
no, but it's really exciting what's happening right now. And if, like I said, if you can hop on the wave, and what really kind of sealed the deal.
And let me just say one thing. You say in the tablet, but if you look at Windows 8, you've got a whole screen now that's touchscreen.
Right.
So you might even want to expand it to a giant touchscreen.
That's true. We'll see how Windows goes right now.
People don't want touchscreens. Yeah. They want tablets, but they don't want a touchscreen computer. Yeah. They never have. It hurts your back. It hurts your shoulders. We've had this conversation before. I will mention this too, Bobby. If you don't like the imprecision of a tablet, imagine the imprecision of like five-finger multi-touch on a tablet.
That's what I'm thinking. Exactly.
Yeah, it's not for everybody. It's not for everybody. But the, you know, HP and Sony, all these, I've lost track of who's done what, but so many of these companies have had touchscreen home computers for a really long time. And it seems like a great idea until you actually, you don't even have to buy one and try it. Go to Best Buy and play with it for 5 minutes. It's not an enjoyable experience. Yep. It seems a lot cooler than it ends up being.
I just have one word and it's kids. That's it. I don't know a kid that has a clean hand, you know? Yeah. And you don't want them touching the screen. But getting back to the tablet thing, the last thing that I want to say about that kind of sealed the deal on the whole paradigm shift is today Steinberg released Cubasis for the iPad, and it's a baby Cubase. Ooh. And you can start, and it comes with instruments, and you can do tracks, and you can do audio. But the cool thing is you can start on Cubasis and then move it to Cubase if you have Cubase. You don't have to. But just that whole that's just one little sliver of where this is going and where the direction that we're going in. And so, you know, you just got to be aware that sometimes these changes, even though they're kind of really small and seem incremental, this is a big deal. This really is a big deal, and we're getting to witness it. And in 5, 10 years, you're going to look back and you're going to say, "Man, I remember when that started. I remember right then and there on the Audio Nowcast."
I have a question for Rob, speaking of that. So if you're a developer and you're developing for the iPad and perhaps you can get $999 out of it, is it worth it to put your resources into that?
Well, I think it is if you can. The idea is you would sell a zillion more copies because it's an impulse item. And if someone wants to make music and does a search and your thing pops up on top, you know, all the prices are so incredibly low that you can sell a much bigger volume. The other thing is
can you upsell them though to something else though? That's the whole thing.
Well, you can if they reach the limit of what they can achieve on that little platform. You know, if they're playing with it on their iPad and then it's time to start doing some serious overdubs and stuff, and if they do a lot of productions, I think it does naturally sell the Big Brother product. The other thing to keep in mind is if these things are developed properly, it doesn't have to be a completely separate code base for the iOS stuff. So like if you've developed a true Mac application in Objective-C or in, you know, using some native development toolkit on the Mac, it's not that big a deal. I mean, it's still a big deal, but it's not like starting from scratch to redo your program in iOS.
Well, that's cool. Well, having said that about pricing, Cubase is not cheap. It's $50.
Wow. Okay?
But that's expensive.
So is Aria, right?
Yeah,
Aria is $50.
That's expensive for iOS world. But come on, you know, in Pro Audio, that's nothing. $50, you know? If you told me you could get a plugin for $50, you know, we'd buy it with pocket change because it's, you know, you're talking hundreds of dollars, you know.
Yeah, that's right. A $99 plug-in, you're going, wow.
How much was a roll of tape of 2-inch tape?
$250.
Oh, yeah, over $250.
Yeah. I mean, that was –
And you would get maybe, if you're real lucky, 3 songs on it. or 2 if they were long.
You used to spend $200 just to record your music, not even talking about the
sound mic. The sound was so good.
So that's all to say. You know, I want to move on to the next thing we're going to talk about, but I just wanted people to – be aware, take, you know, watch. It's going to affect everybody. It's going to affect how we make music. It's going to affect, you know, the
type of music. And which is going to be great then in I guess, January, February at the NAMM show. It'll be interesting to see. I remember last NAMM show, there were a ton of pads.
Yeah.
Now I'm curious to see what that next step's going to be.
I think there'll be a ton of pads too. And I mean,
I can tell you what part of the danger of that is, though. Some of the pad software is emulating computer software that's emulating
instruments in real life.
Yeah.
But so now it's like two steps away because they have to be real careful with the horsepower in the tablets. I mean, the newer tablets have a lot more power, but for something to be able to run on an old tablet, you end up with these approximations, and they might sound good enough, but if you actually compare them with what they're emulating, you'll hear a big difference. And at some point, there'll be backlash to that too.
You mean like Wave and MP3?
No, I look at it more like, you know, we're talking in Sonic Mirage to, you know, the Akai S1000 to, you know, to what we have now. It's just, it's growing. We're at the beginning, you know, We get to see this thing all work itself out. But
well, and the Martin doesn't look convinced.
Well, you know, I'm fascinated just listening to it, you know, because it seems that I'm still, you know, I'm still locked in that world of the analog and the big keyboards, and I like playing around with the digital domain. But ultimately, for me as a songwriter and as a singer, you're always looking for the best quality you can record something at. And but I'm sure, Mike, I'm sure you're onto something here, because it's obviously going to be the beginning of something that'll last, you know. But as a songwriter and as a singer, it always comes down to me, we've got a good preamp here. Does the microphone really bring out the emotion?
But I think the thing is mobile technologies, and I think it's mobile technologies, the network. And that's where I'm looking forward to seeing the next step, because it might, like, again, it might be 3-4 things. Your computer, a couple pads, everything's talking to each other, which makes things easier rather than a zillion cables.
For me as a songwriter as well, I have to look at what really makes me write the best songs that I possibly can. And the way that I work.
Yeah. You know what? You bring up...
And I think the new technology, it really suits dance music.
Right.
It really, really suits high-tech dance music. It doesn't suit some other kinds of music quite so well. It's as real as that.
Not yet, though. I mean,
I'm sure you're right.
But you bring up a fantastic point, and that's, you know, what it all comes down to is what's going to help you be a better songwriter. I mean, ultimately, that's what it comes down to.
Performer, too.
And what kind of songwriter you are, or what kind of performer you are, and what kind of music you do. Yeah. You have to really go through the forest and go, what works for me?
But it might be as you play your acoustic instrument, you might record it to your little flat screen recorder.
Absolutely.
Just because it's easy.
And there's going to be new musical instruments. I mean, there already is. There's already new iPad instruments where you can watch some of the demos on YouTube, where you see them playing these, you know, like Celine and some of these other instruments, and there's emotion, and they can do pressure by not how hard they tap, but where they tap and where they slide their finger to get modulation, to get pressure.
I'm not the tech head here, but as a songwriter, I think the songwriter has to sit there and say, some of this is fantastic, but what really works for me?
Yeah.
And there's so much to go through now, because in the 70s and 80s and 90s, it was really what, you know, MIDI, a drum machine and a tape machine, and that's what you had to deal with. Now there are so many options that the young songwriter has to think, what kind of music do I write? How do I perform? What's the best equipment for me personally? So that it doesn't get too sidetracked into doing something, the technology rules him, and I'm talking as a songwriter.
Sure.
But sometimes the technology can start making you go, well, I need to follow this track. And it may not be the best track for you as a original songwriter or artist. And I think that's the difficulty now, is how many things there are out there that you have to weed through to go, what really is the best clothes I can wear?
The distractions.
Yeah.
The distractions from the tools. Which, you know what? We're going to segue into the next thing we're going to talk about, and this is a really great way. I want to talk about gear, and I wanted to talk about gear on a different level. Not so much on the technology side of things, but it was interesting when I was preparing for the podcast, and I was reading some of the questions on some of the blogs about.
You prepare for the podcast?
You believe it or not.
Okay, wow.
And I was reading some of the questions and some of the comments about Cubasis and this new tool that was coming out. And you know, whenever you start a conversation that has to do with computers or making music on a computer, why does it always devolve into Logic versus Pro Tools versus Cubase? I mean, you ever notice that no matter what the topic is, it all of a sudden comes down to this troll war about, you know, well, Logic hasn't been updated. Well,
musical tribalism. Been
music. Yeah. And you know, but I wanted to think about it on a – I step back for a second and I'm thinking, why do these guys feel such a personal hurt that when someone says something negative against their piece of gear, against their software.
Well, it was Triad against just, Neve against SSL.
Yeah, but it's like
Atari against
why,
Chevy against Ford.
Right.
Yeah, you know.
It's like, but why are they, you know, why are they so emotional?
Because they spent
attached.
A lot of money on it and they want to be the winner.
Well,
it's a pretty easy answer, actually.
Go ahead. Answer me.
Okay. It's because people don't want to appear like idiots having chosen the wrong thing, and everybody becomes a true believer in whatever it is they're using.
Right.
It's the same reason people used to argue that they have the best stereo speakers or right. the best whatever, because you right. don't want to you don't want to believe that maybe you chose the wrong one. It's one of the reasons why I always come back to you should learn a little of all of them and be objective if you really do care
right.
about which is the best. The trick is to sort of spend a little bit of time and stay on top of all of them to learn. But you get a lot of people who are so totally vehemently opposed to anything except what they're using. And then you ask if they've ever checked out any of the others, and the answer is no.
You know, that's really great because, again, I think that relates to the kind of music you might want to write or you might want to perform. Because you can even read the magazines and you can see that some of Logic may be better for this kind of music.
Right.
And Pro Tools or Cubase may suit film music or if you're a folk artist or whatever. But you still have to use technology. I mean, that's the way – you need to read the magazines because yeah. the magazines really break it down. And that's really what I do. I just want to say – yeah, I read it just to think what would work best for my creativity. I mean, it comes down to that because you can be ruled by technology. It's happened to me where you sit there and you go, what a great gimmick. I need to write that into a song and play with it. So you have to sort of, you know, analyze yourself
right.
as a human being before you even get into this.
Well, when I was reading these comments and I see all this emotional attachment that they were having, and it was definitely emotional. I mean, these people from their just the way they were writing, you could tell they had not just a vested interest yeah. on a intellectual level. They were emotionally connected. I started thinking about emotional connections with our gear. And that's what I wanted to talk about right now, kind of as we wrap up this whole year of 2012.
Our love story.
Take yeah. your analog gear out on a date.
No,
our affairs.
But here's the thing. Really.
I'm cheating on my analog.
I'm cheating on my analog.
No, you know
– yeah.
It's,
I dated some plugins. Oh my God.
Yeah.
But it's,
I still love my MPC 16.
We joke, but really, we all have an emotional true. Attachment to our gear on some level. And I'll give you a great example. Recently, Martin got rid of his big mixing console that was in his. In his studio, and that
don't
desk,
remind me. I'm going to break down again.
But seriously, I mean, that desk went through. There was a lot of stuff that was written yeah. on that. You know, the House of Stone and Light album, and there, you know, a couple other albums and a couple other songs. And I remember talking to him, you know, the night before, and asking him if he felt a little weird about it. And I remember you did. You
how
felt,
do you feel?
You know, well, you know, it was for me. It was a. I wanted it to go to a good home. People that wanted to use the board properly, and luckily. I found a record company through you, Mike, at Interscope, that wanted to do it up and bring it back to life. I certainly felt like it had more life in it and it had a great history. You know, I mean, really, a lot of the records, you know, the Go West, Faithful, King Wishful Thinking, were all recorded on that. And I wrote it all down, took photographs of it and kept records that... You know, we did a lot of Robbie Robertson stuff on there on his first solo record and then transferred it. A lot of hits were on there. And, yeah, I had a real attachment to it because, and this is very interesting, again, from the songwriter's point of view, I was never really technical. I knew how to drive it. I knew how to get to make it work. I knew its power to me. And it was emotional to let go of it. I tended to, for years and years, it had just been there, and I walked into the garage and looked at it and went like, oh, there she is. It's like the Titanic. There she is.
What console was it?
It was a TS-24 56 channel.
Oh, good one.
Yeah, it was nice. Large. It took a lot of people to get out. but it really served me really well. I mean, I tend to keep equipment for a long period of time.
Absolutely.
And I use it right through until it says it can't be used anymore. I was emotionally attached. But the funny thing, again, I thought I was giving it to a good home.
Right.
And I started to feel like I wasn't doing it justice, that other people really wanted that board. And the guy who took it was so proud to get it, you know.
That's nice.
And the only thing I did was I slept with it for 3 nights. For
No, but, you know, I remember coming over to your garage. Wait, how do you say that?
Garage.
For f***ing sake. Garage.
The garage is a whole different thing.
It's an insult, Rob. It's an insult. It's a garage. Yes.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you.
Wow,
Rob.
Jeremy, there's a big edit there.
Oh, I don't think so, Jeremy. Don't you dare cut that.
No, but I was choking. That was so funny. No, but I remember going into the studio, and I'll be honest, it was a little. There was a little bit of a sense of loss for me too, because I remember. I mean, that's where we started working together, and. Yeah. I remember.
That's the great thing, though. I have to say, to you know, when we talk about all this new gear, is when I bought stuff back in the 80s, I bought stuff that everybody had said to me it's going to last for a long time, and it's not going to. It's going to always be steady, and that's why when you get your APIs and you get your Neumann 87, you know that you're going to use that gear and it's going to last all the way through. And this Soundcraft did. And it was a very, very good board to track on. It wasn't the best to mix on, but right. It was terrific to track on, had good preamps. But, you know, what was pretty amazing, when I bought it back then, it was over $80,000. And I gave this away, you know, at this point. It was just like, because I knew it was a good home, and it was very hard to move because it was big and it was a real unit, you know. It was a solid thing. And in fact, the people that bought it wanted it to look like that. They wanted people to walk into a studio and say, look at this board we've got. So
you reclaimed a major piece of real estate when that left the room, didn't you?
I'm telling you, Robert, it took 6 hours for the guys to take all the channels out individually and lay them on the floor.
Wow.
And then take the shell out and take it out the backyard and by the pool. I took photos. There were men that were actually sort of almost dying out there going like, I can't hold the end of this up any longer. And they brought a huge truck over. It was done very professionally, and I thought it might take 3 hours, but it took about half a day to do.
Yeah, I think professionally, though, you know, I've had so much gear in my lifetime.
Yeah, but I bet there's gear. There's certain pieces of gear. Well, attached to
everything from like when I was in college, I used to watch with envy. Like we were talking about the Jupiter 6.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think, oh my God, it was like $5,000. It was something. It was so out of bounds. That years later, when I found one, someone was going to pawn it. I bought it immediately, and I didn't care because I always wanted it. And when you look at gear, that one of the strangest times is we had a couple of studios, Signet being one of them, as well as some of the scoring stage. And they took all this gear and they warehoused it actually right behind my room. And it was 800s and Ataris and LA2As and. And the thing was, like, we had 4 synclaviers and about 100 waveframes.
Oh.
Now, watching all this gear just set up, everything in that room was stuff I dreamed about when I was younger. The weird part is now, synclaviers, couldn't get a penny for them.
Right. Yeah.
Waveframes, had to throw them out.
Yeah.
You know, we had all this gear that really had very little to no value. SR cards. SR cards for days, you know, and
you have to know when to sell that stuff.
Absolutely. But it was just something that they collected and they sold, and some to Vintage King and other ones to just, you know, other people. But it was amazing to see what was the royalty of technology in the back
that had no, a lot of it had no home.
But so look at Bobby. We were over there, Mike, weren't we? And Bobby's lovingly, fitting up this Neve board, and he's absolutely.
Oh yeah.
You can see he's and he called me recently and just said, I'm getting it together, and it's like he's really in love with what he's doing and bringing it back to life, and that's he's emotionally attached to that new Neve board, well, old Neve board.
That's the thing is it's that emotional bond that he's going through as he's putting it together and wiring it and checking everything.
Well, he has the benefit that he can actually wire it himself mod it himself, which is a big difference from most people.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. But there's that. I don't know. I just found, as I was.
But when he was doing that, he was drooling, wasn't he?
Microphones when you collect, like I'm a collector of microphones.
Yeah,
I am too.
And David Bach built me a custom 47. Oh, and I'm like, it's just like, I sat there and I'm like shaking Dave. Oh, thank you, Dave. And I'm like, and I got my little baby here. And he did this little strange mod for me, and I just loved it, and it's near and dear.
I think people feel that for guitars, don't they?
Oh,
yeah. Musical instruments is a big emotional attachment. Bobby, is there any piece of gear or any instrument that you feel attached to, emotionally attached to?
No.
and Bobby's soulless and heartless.
I've had all sorts of gear that I've gotten rid of over the years, as we all have, but I've always looked at it like, no big deal, I'll get something better. So it's never bothered me, and I got it. Well, okay. There's a few things that I wish I had, but I don't think about it much. I don't much care.
Right.
So no, I'm pretty heartless about the whole thing right now.
I think Bobby's got the healthy way to look at
it. No, that's pretty. It's definitely.
But
pretty
there's
healthy.
Also some, like, there are some microphones that I sing on now, and I go, like, these are never going to break down, and these just sound so amazing.
Or you have one that
I think you go in seasons with your gear, though. I think there's certain pieces of gear that you fall in love with, and you'll use as much as you can use it, and then something else will come along.
But there's a difference here. There's a difference. I mean, part of it is when it becomes your sound. And you can get
absolutely
what you need to get as a professional as quickly as possible. Yeah. That's different because that becomes a tool that you can rely on.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you're looking at it differently at that point.
And you're comfortable with.
Yeah.
It's so funny you say that because we're going through something similar with Martin Studio right now. We're trying to plan for the future. And quite frankly, we've gone a couple different ways. But what he has right now is working, right?
Extremely
and
well.
And he's in a groove and doing a lot of writing. And it's like,
Why mess with something? Yeah.
Why rock the boat if you don't have to?
Yeah, absolutely.
So we're
in. That's a huge, statement to the people that are listening is that once you there's so many quick things coming on the market, it's great to actually sometimes learn what you've got. And live with it for a while, and as Bobby said, make it your own sound, and it becomes something that you really can use well because you've spent a certain amount of time with it. You have to choose your equipment carefully because there's such a quick turnaround that you sometimes don't really get into it, make it yours, and it becomes comfortable, and you know how to play it like an instrument.
Right.
There's so much out there that you can say, I need this now, I need that. But sometimes you find a few things, and you have to be wise about it and say, this is very special. It's a Rolls Royce. It works. I understand it, and I know how to get the best out of it. And that's where you have to sort of sit back from just throwing the money out at the new thing, and just saying, you know what, the new things are good, and I'll check them out. But
you know how to get the best out of it quickly. That's the other thing.
Absolutely.
I never feel bad about going into a situation with gear that I don't know about. I know that eventually I can make it work, and it'll sound really good.
Yeah.
But the problem is, how long is it going to take me to get there?
Right.
So
right.
If there's stuff I know, I'll get there quickly, and if there's stuff I don't know, it's going to take longer.
Yeah.
I don't know how much.
Well, the weird thing also, like, I deal with probably more plugins.
Yeah.
And I just actually re-racked all my old gear, and I put it all. I mean, I cut off the rack of doom because it's like now it's about 6.5 feet tall, It's just it's just kind of like just the coolest of the gear that I had, and the other gear is not on the floor. But with plugins, what's different is I remember Like, I actually like a plugin called Phoenix Crane Song.
Oh, of course, yeah.
And when we went to Pro Tools 10, for about a year, it didn't exist. And I love how it just, how it touches the mid-range. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh my God, I don't have that. So then I think what I don't like about the plugin world is the transientness of... You have it? Oh, now you don't have it. Sometimes you don't even know.
That's frightening. Yeah. That's frightening to me.
That is so true, because like Master X from TC, I love that plugin. Yes. Right?
You go a lot of people.
You go to Pro Tools 10, gone.
Gone.
It's not, doesn't work, won't work, it's not going to work. And you're like...
Some of the TC stuff, not working.
Yep. So
no TDM, gone.
Hey, Rob, let me ask you.
Yes?
Emotional attachment, any of your gear?
Well, I'm definitely not a good person to talk to about parting with gear.
Sharon has DOS gear. Still, yes.
And I am guilty of spooning with my API lunchbox on occasion. you know, I'm a big believer. I do have a lot of gear, but I am a big believer in, as often as possible, taking a piece of gear that you haven't messed with in a while. If you do have an arsenal of toys that you built up over the years, take a piece of gear you haven't messed with for a little while and really dig deep into it. Maybe get out the manual and read it again, or just spend a whole day trying to create with it. I've actually bought less and less gear as the years have gone on, because I keep finding new things about the gear I already have. And it's been a long time since a new keyboard came out that was truly like a groundbreaking, totally different sound.
Right.
To me. So, I mean, if all you're ever going to do is call up the factory presets of any synth, then yeah, you need to buy new keyboards all the time. But the truth is, any modern synth is capable of a billion times more than what the factory presets hand you. And I like, you know, trying to have my stuff sound original. So that's the way I don't let my gear get stale. I will go back and relearn it as if I just got it home from the store that day. And that includes things that I bought 20 years ago.
Right. What's the last one you bought?
The last major gear, it was probably the Oasis, the Korg Oasis keyboard, which is sort of like my flagship keyboard I can sit behind, and I feel like I'm flying the space shuttle, you know, with the touch screen and all the pads and everything it does. I love that thing because it's really like a universe on its own, and in my studio, I find it daunting to have too much technology when I'm in songwriter or composer mode. So I'll often switch on just the Oasis, which has a massive amount of stuff in it. But it's nice to limit yourself so you're not thinking about the gear as much as you're thinking about the music.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And actually, I'm in Austin right now working on a project, as you mentioned earlier. And I'm using a very small amount of gear because I need to make sure I write songs with this band that are appropriate for the band. And it's not about a huge array of gear. It's about songs that are a good emotional connection between this band and the audience. It's good to limit the technology when you're in that songwriting mode. I think it's important to realize that if you're a musician, you go through different modes all the time in your career. Writing a song is different than recording a song, is different than mixing a song, is different than promoting a song. They're completely different parts of your brain and they require different gear. And if you can specialize in each one or sort of focus on each one, you do a better job on each one. But unless you're like a dance producer who needs a million different sound effects and crazy just technical things going on, and that's the way you write, most of the time it's good to limit the technology for writing and then open up the floodgates when it's time to produce. And I find myself constantly going between those.
Very true.
You know, that's a great point. And, you know, as we're here talking about emotional attachments, and some of us have them to gear, Martin, and some of us don't, Bobby. but all in all, I think what you got to remember is if you have that favorite mic, if you have that favorite, you know, computer, plug-in, whatever, you know, learn and use it as much as you can, because it's what you have. And money can't buy talent, right? I mean, you can't buy your way into being good on a guitar. You got to practice. You know, you can't buy your way into being good in really anything. It all comes down to doing it.
You know, sometimes as a songwriter as well, as again, with following up on what Rob said, is you sometimes don't even get the best sounds when you're writing. You're just moving and you're looking at the chords and you're looking at spontaneity.
Right.
And so, you know, usually the demo is very, pretty rough and just on the spot. And then you look back at that even and you go, oh, it's pretty good. You know, it's right. Like your creativity, and this is where I'm coming from, your creativity has to come more from what you create and what you write, and the technology has to help you.
Right.
But sometimes the sound can
absolutely, that's
can
true
also
as well.
It, yeah. Can inspire yeah. you.
Yeah. Rob, were you going to say something?
Yeah. Yeah, I actually, you know, as I've been thinking about it, because you spring these questions on us, Mike, and we don't have any chance to think about it.
I said I prepare for the podcast, not you prepare for the podcast.
Hey, I showed up. it actually occurred to me that the piece of gear that I probably have the biggest emotional attachment to right now in my studio is one that doesn't make any sound, and that's the D-Control console. You know, I have a large D-Control console. It makes no sound. It's just a control surface, but it makes me happy. And it inspires me. And when I sit down, it's like sitting down at a giant video game, and I smile every time I sit down at the thing.
Yeah, you know, that makes a lot of sense.
But it's just from an inspirational happiness point of view, it improves my day, and I know I work better because I'm fiddling with it.
You know, does that mean all your songs are happy, Rob?
No, none of them are happy.
No, but you know what? That's a great point, though. Really good point that, you know, the gear that you feel emotionally attached to, or that you even feel attached to, is maybe something that doesn't make any noise at all. It kind of gets you going, whether it's the, I know what Rob's talking about, because I like going into my studio and I like just being in front of a console, even though I'm a mouse mixer. You know, there's something cool about
that. What console do you have?
The D-Command.
Oh, we have a D-Command too.
Yeah. And, you know, there's something cool about it. I mean, I know I'd like to go into Scott's room every day.
Well, you know, I've got a D-Command as a sound designer. And, you know, I've had lots of different mixing consoles, all analog to the mouse. And when I'm formulating sounds, and touch interfacing is huge. So when I sound design and when I mix, to me, it's the same as my guitars and my instrument. I'm very fussy. The faders have to be right. The knobs have to be right. Otherwise, it just resonates badly with me. Because when I sit there, I got to be able to touch the sound. It's kind of a weird, my ears, my touch. So when I'm just goosing something or interface with something, just ever so slightly, the interface is important.
Right.
And when I got the D command, it was nice because it's so long I've gone into the mouse and analog, and sometimes I just wanted to do these really intricate automated moves, and having a knob that I can just touch really quick and move. I had a Chore 24, hated the faders. Yeah. It reminded more like a lighting console than it was a sound console. The D command I went in, and I liked it quite a bit, and I've got a lot of tactile controllers. So when I'm designing and when I'm mixing, I become very intimate with my technology because my ears and my ears want to hear something, so my hands got to do something like an instrument. And a lot of it's very subtle because I'm listening very carefully. And like for me, plugins, especially this year, I think in the last 12 to 18 months, I've been on a massive mission to find technology and give me something, because I'm creating a lot of things for this project. And I've been going to Europe and Germany and all these different plug-in manufacturers. And there's one that I really dig by Saturn. It's called FabFilter, and it's a multi-band saturator. Now, all of a sudden, instead of like saying, oh, put it through a guitar amp. Yeah, but it's too broadband. Now I can do like a little grunge in the mids, a little tape roll off in the highs, and I can have as many bands as I want. It could be two bands. It could be four bands. Now I'm able to add distortion or saturation, depends, in different degrees and different flavors to one sound.
Yeah.
And now if I want to have it cut through the mix a little bit and add a little edge, just a little bit, within a specific frequency,
right,
I have that ability to shape it to give it a little bit aggression, a little bit of an edge. It's been wonderful. I mean,
I'm
a sound designer, you know.
Yeah, you're a sound designer and you get a vibe off your plugins and the board and stuff like that. All this to say is it's amazing when you start realizing where your emotional attachments are and how they affect the job that you do and what pieces of gear. I think once you start looking at how you look at your gear, you'll be able to know what what gear you need and what gear you don't need. And
you know what? Unless you're in the business of selling gear, your gear should be a tool that you learn how to use and then forget about.
Sure.
You should be worrying about your art. You should be worrying about what it is you're trying to create. The gear is really an incidental thing. I wish I could be as unattached to it as Bobby is, because it's really unhealthy as attached to it as I am.
Yeah.
But the truth is, you shouldn't be attached to it. It's a tool. And if a better tool comes along, you should get rid of the worst tool and get the better tool.
Right.
And, you know, unless you're in the business of gear or you have a passion for the gear itself, in which case, just admit that that's what your passion is.
Yeah.
You should really be worried about what you're trying to create.
If you can't afford the, you know, certain gear, the gear you've got to get very close to and make it work.
Yeah.
You know, so well, for a lot of people out there, if they've just got, you know, a certain amount to play with, they've got to get pretty into that and make that
work. People make an excuse sometimes that they say, well, I don't have that, so I can't do this.
Yeah.
But
it happens all the time. Or people, you know, I've heard plenty of musicians say, oh, you know, if I only had that other guitar or that other bass or that other keyboard. And I'm always thinking, no, what you really need is music lessons. I've heard plenty of people play a $5 guitar and they're awesome and incredible. And I've heard people pay a $20,000 guitar and they suck.
This was great. I mean, one of the people that Mike works with, we did a trailer recently.
Yeah.
And I heard a sound. I went, ooh, I like where'd you get the sound from? It was all I created. And I'm like, okay, what'd you use? Because I like there's something really cool that's going on. Oh, I use blah, blah, blah. I use this little...
He told you what he used? What an idiot.
Yeah, well. and it was great. I love to be able to explore because it's infinite. I mean, and that's what... Sometimes it's not the guy who has the best gear. It's not the guy who has the most gear.
Yeah.
Because sometimes you find someone said, this is all I had. And I just found a unique way of using it. That's just really cool. Yeah.
He sound designs on Ableton, just so you know.
Yeah, no, I know. It was different tools.
Ableton.
He sound designs on Ableton. Hey, why am I going to end the year?
I called him up there and we talked about it. It was great. And he had a totally different approach. It doesn't matter who you come from. I mean, everybody, whether even it's my son, who doesn't know. And that's what's great about creativity. It sometimes comes in the most rawest forms.
Yeah.
I have a good story, quick story.
Yeah, go ahead.
To follow up what Rob was saying, I for one tour, I was a musical director for Mick Taylor, ex-Rolling Stone. And for that tour, Mick didn't bring a guitar or an amplifier. Every single night, he relied on somebody to get him something, whether it be a rental, whether it be a fan, come in and say, oh, please play my guitar. And he played some of the crappiest stuff I've ever seen. And every night, it sounded like Mick Taylor. It didn't matter what he used.
That's awesome.
It sounded like Mick Taylor.
Well,
that says a lot.
That's actually, you know what? That's actually a great way to wrap up this whole conversation about your gear. And it's ultimately what you do with your gear. You know, as we go into the holiday season and people are wanting new toys and you want, you know, the next best thing. You know, sometimes the next best thing is actually what you have right in front of you.
Yes.
You know? Yeah. And I guess when I want to wrap this up by saying, you know, gear is merely a tool. The, you know, talking about the iPad and how inexpensive some of the products are getting, you know, there's a lot of opportunities at a lot of different price points for people to create music and to create audio. And you know, just keep that in mind that it's just a tool. And don't go into debt, you know, and don't. Don't hurt yourself for your gear because it's not worth it because it's going to be, you know, it's going to be obsolete and, you know, and the 5-year cycle that technology is, you know.
And when you live with it and it's all you have, you will make the best of it if you're passionate about your music.
There's something to be said for having less.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You should always be in that mindset. Even if you have more, you should be in the mindset of having to make the best out of what – you know, small subset of gear you're focusing on at that moment, it's always a better thing. I mean, the gear, you should really be able to forget about it.
Yeah.
Wasn't it Sgt. Pepper 4-track? Was it 4-track?
Yes, it was, yeah.
It's just, it's amazing what has been done with less. So just keep that in mind. And
bit like your sex life, right?
What a finish. Wow, where did that come from?
Scored in the last minute.
Manchester United.
He keeps, he flips.
Just not
he runs. Yeah. Hey, goal!
But anyhow, Jeremy News and Edit. No, I'm just kidding. But, you know, having said that, just, you know, realize where we're at. There's a lot of exciting things going on. I mean, think about it. Rob is talking to us from Austin on a little iPad mini that we have at the end of the table.
The Dick Tracy thing, huh? You know,
it's as thin as a couple pieces of paper, and it's just amazing the time that we're living in. So keep it all in perspective. And if you're going to go on the boards, for goodness sakes, don't be a troll. If somebody says something negative about whatever piece of gear it is, don't take it too personally, because you know what? It's just gear after all. And there's plenty of better, bigger stuff is coming down the pipe.
You could say gear as tools, couldn't you? Really? Yeah. The same word.
Yeah.
Well, plus, unless you invented that particular piece of gear they're making fun of, what kind of vested interest do you have anyway?
Yeah, I know. I just want to tell people to chill out, you know, on some of these boards. But anyway. And you know what? Ultimately, it comes down to, I can honestly say, the podcast is a great example. It's not the gear. We talk about gear and we talk about all kinds of really cool subjects and we have interesting guests. But ultimately, I get the most joy out of just interacting with you gentlemen that are around the table every week. It's the fun that we have. And it's not only the fun that we have on the podcast, but it's the conversations after and it's the conversations before, and it's all of that. And
see, I always thought it was the cool mic that you're using.
It does look good, doesn't it? Yeah.
See, I know it can't be about the gear because the podcast gear never works.
No, that's only when you're not here.
Okay.
All right. Well, hey, listen. As we wrap up this year, I'm gonna learn how to talk. As we wrap up this year and we look back, I just want to thank all the listeners out there for continuing to listen to us. And like I said, we've been really kind of sporadic this year on the podcast, and hopefully next year we won't be quite as sporadic. But it just means everybody's busy and everybody has interesting stories that they're working on. And I can't wait to see Rob in real life. I haven't seen him in
I've heard he's gotten shorter.
It'll be nice to see you guys. It's been about 3.5 months since I've been there.
It's been a while. But before we go, Bobby, are you working on anything you can talk about?
I got tons of stuff, actually. I have a series of books called Deconstructed Hits coming out next year.
Oh, awesome.
And also a series of called From the Vault, about 10 books that are archives from my blogs, from the Music 3.0 blog and from the Big Picture production blog. And I'm also planning a speaking tour, so I'm going to be doing clinics and workshops at a city near you.
Wow. Nice. Hey, really quick, I need to plug your Music 3.0 blog. That's a really great blog. All Bobby's blogs are great, but read the Music 3.0. It really it's really interesting. He posts a lot of really cool things. And, you know, you really have the benefit of reading what Bobby posts, but then also get to hear him on this podcast, and he really has a great insight. And it's just I feel honored every time you hear him.
Why? Thank you, Mike.
I will thank you kindly.
That.
No, it's really true. Rob, how about yourself? Are you working on anything?
I'm just traveling around the country. I'm trying to see how long I can continue to pay my mortgage and not step foot in my house. So far, that's going well. No, I'm doing a lot of things. Actually, just finishing up
24 hours a day.
I'm actually finishing up a video game project with Mr. Gershon's company. Actually, that may have finished today. We're not sure. But
I think so. I wake up at 4 in the morning, and he's still emailing away.
Wow.
It's long.
Oh, I put in 3 20-hour days in a row last week, and I don't recommend that to anyone. But yeah, it hasn't been a boring time. So we're finishing up that video game. I'm also involved in a software venture. That's one of the reasons I've been out of town for so long, and I'll be able to start talking about that in the beginning of the year. It's a new technology that I helped invent, and it's just one of the most exciting things that's ever happened to me. So I'm looking forward to being able to talk about that. And also, I'm here in Austin producing a band, which I'm also very excited about. So no shortage of stuff going on. Early this year, things were a little bit slow, which is almost impossible to remember. And the trick when things are slow is to just keep honing your skills and polishing your talent and waiting for things to speed up again. But now things have been like gangbusters. So very exciting year and a lot of amazing stuff coming next year.
Great. Well, we're looking forward to seeing you and, like I said, in person, brother.
And yeah, and I'm already I'm making all of my commitments now for the NAMM show. So I believe I will be at the NAMM show doing a few things for a few different manufacturers. I always have a good time there.
We're working on getting a NAMM podcast, just so you know, from NAMM. And I'll tell you about that later. Just
all right, cool.
Just want to let you know. So save an evening between like 5 and 7.
Okay.
Scott, how about you?
Hello!
I know. We're working on a project that
I know
a lot of people have kind of touched.
Well, you know, it's good. I can actually talk a little bit now. Well, two things. The first one is I did a little indie film called Any Day Now that's opened sold-out audiences in New York and L.A. and D.C. Alan Cummings is the lead, and a friend of mine did the film. It's super low budget, but it's kind of gone viral, and it's getting huge buzz. They're talking even potential Oscar, and it's great. He wrote it, directed it, and brought his friends in, and it's really it's catching on. So that's great to see, and that was something that I supervised and I mixed it. I did it very old school. It was me, director. I had a couple friends coming for a couple days, but pretty much old school. It was just me and a director in a room for about a month and a half. Wow. That's it, which they don't do that anymore. There wasn't a backfield, and we edited it and mixed it all together. Then I checked it in a big theater, played really well, and that was it. And it was very fun and just hanging out and very intimate. The other one I've been working on since I did that actually right before, did that like November of last year. And it's won, by the way, all the festivals. It's gone Toronto and Santa Fe, and it's been winning at all of them. The other one I can now talk about, I've been working on since February, this little petite film. The trailer came out with The Hobbit, and the movie's called Pacific Rim.
Pacific Rim.
Pacific Rim. with Guillermo del Toro. And so now I can say what it is and where it's at. And the trailer's gone viral, and we're using all new technologies. We're going to be using Atmos and been learning lots about that technology. And it's fun. I mean, it's one of those things that you never have the time, or you never have the money, or you never have something. And I think we have all of it now. So it's been one of those projects that, you know, come once, twice in a lifetime, where they say, how good are you?
Right.
You know, what can you actually do? And it's very intimidating having that, but it's great. And I feel like I'm learning again. And
great challenge.
It is. And I'm kind of like looking under the hood on everything that I can look at, every plug-in, every gear. What did I used to do that I liked? Something I never even thought about doing.
Right.
And so it's all very challenging and the fun, and it's just a wonderful experience so far. And the movie comes out in July, and I think I finish in June. So,
you know, we have to also mention that it's a project that three of us here at the table have worked on, well, at least the trailer, because Brandon did sound design for the trailer, working along with Scott.
Yep.
And then and so they worked on the trailer, and then I mixed all the online viral video stuff. So it was kind of interesting using their sounds and adding some mixing in my head. It's like we all kind of touched it on the launch. That was kind of fun, actually. So well done on the trailer, though. That trailer is really, truly epic. I can't wait to see the film in Atmos. That looks fun.
I will say one thing that's fun is that I've already done the film twice.
Wow.
And what's great is you do it the first time, and you do like you would do any other project, and then you say, God, I wish I would have. And now you do it again, and then you go, okay. Now we're kind of starting on we're in the middle of our second run. Then we get a third run where you go, okay, we get to the point where you want to run out of ideas.
Yeah.
You know, at least conceptually.
Well, I can't wait. Know. It looks good. A lot of big sounds, creatures, the whole shebang.
Usually when you're on a film, I'm on for 16 to 20 weeks. This one I'll be on 85 weeks.
Wow. It's amazing.
So,
speaking of 85 weeks, that's the time between Martin's albums. No, wait, that's years.
No, that's fast. That's if I'm doing it real well.
Martin, what are you up to, brother?
I'm in a, you know, really, really creative place. I'm doing my normal thing, writing songs. For the first time, I found that I've got so many songs in different styles, and I'm not finishing them straight away. So it's like I can move between a folk record, I can move across to an instrumental record, I can move across to maybe another record that sounds like me. And at the same time I'm doing that, I'm enjoying doing something that I promised to do myself for a long time, is archiving all the demos of all the people I ever worked with. And so I was very fortunate that all the records that everybody knows were recorded first in my house. So I've pulled up all the, you know, the original of These Dreams, the original We Built This City, and The King Wishful Thinking, and Faithful, and all the early stuff that people knew me for. And I've got the original demos, so I've mastered them. And that's been really, really encouraging and exciting to be able to find all that stuff. That's been a wonderful journey, just archiving. I'm at that point in my life where I think it hits people around this time when you go, let's have a look what the four tracks were like back in the 80s. And
by the way, that would make an amazing documentary.
Yeah, it would.
To where it started, like, here's the idea I had, here's the demo, and the evolution of all these songs.
And I have that, you see. I've got every stage of the song.
Wow.
And it's very interesting because people have never really ever heard These Dreams. And of course, These Dreams was first recorded by Kim Carnes. And it was a very different, and I wrote it really thinking of a orchestra maneuvers in the dark kind of hymn. So it's a very different kind of demo that Neveson got hold of. And in fact, in Hart's new book, they talk about These Dreams. And there was a really interesting story about it. At the same time, I've started to write all the stories behind the songs and all the people I worked with and the actual way I work and what it was like to be with Barbra Streisand and what it was like to be with Earth, Wind & Fire. And I can remember it all. So I regularly go to the Huntington out at Pasadena, and every 2 days I just sit quietly in a little veil there, and I write about each song that people know about and that I can remember. And I think it's very, very useful for me, and I think it's going to be useful to people that write songs, because it's a very guttural kind of way of writing, and about how it is to have relationships and the nervousness of what it is to collaborate. Yeah. So it's a lot of archiving, writing the stories of the songs while I can still remember them.
Yeah.
And at the same time, I'm working on maybe, it seems to me, three different kinds of styles of music. I'm even doing instrumentals. You know, I got very turned on by Can and Cluster and a lot of that early German stuff. So a lot of, you know, and I've got my Jupiters and DX7s and all the old keyboards have suddenly moved forward, and you've helped me with that, Mike. So it's a kind of looking back, except I think it happens to us around this age. You get to 50, you go, archive, save it all before you kick the bucket and before the brain goes. And it's really enjoyable because you feel really fortunate that your mind's still there to go. And it actually turns you on because, you know, there were some incredible stories. There were some times with, you know, like even the Barbra Streisand time was a very, very interesting time. And working with Kim Carnes in the early years of her career was very, very interesting because Brian and I were two English songwriters that really were which really took over, you know, a very powerful time in LA at that time. And so writing the stories has been encouraging to me as well. And I'm sure Bobby can relate to this, because when you do write it down, your brain goes into a place where suddenly it comes back and you start to live it and you get the colours. You can't live it exactly the same, but the colours and the textures and the smells, and the smell of it. And I can, if I was a songwriter and I was reading, you know, this kind of stuff, I think a lot of the unprofessional things that I do and a lot of the unorganized things I do, which just come from a spiritual side, are coming through. And I think that'll help people that write songs.
You know. Fantastic.
Thank you.
And I do want to say, and I have to put this plug in, that I had the honor to listen to some of the music that Martin's been writing. And let me just tell you, it's phenomenal. I mean, it's just, you ain't heard nothing yet. So that's all I'm going to say.
Thank you very much.
And what's up with you, Mike?
Well, I'm still any day now waiting for my Kids Sleep project to launch the website. And that's actually fun. It's a property, and it's, you know what? It's great when you own the property, like when they're your stories and you record it and talent. And I mean, it's just really fun. And so it's kind of cool. And
I've seen some of that stuff, and it's great.
Yeah, and the artist that did the artwork is phenomenal. It'll be fun. And that's mainly it. And all of this talking about gear and emotional attachment, the whole thing. You know, I've been whittling down my gear. I'm trying to get simple. I'm trying to just get small, powerful pieces. You know, I've got an amazingly powerful laptop. You know, I've got the laptop. But I just want to get small and lean and mean, you know, and just trim the fat and just go on with life. There's so many more important things on this planet than technology, you know. I just want to be the first to say. No, and especially some of the stuff that recently have happened and, you know, in the news and things, it's just, you got to remember what's important. And so as we're ending this podcast and the whole holiday, you know what? The important thing isn't the gear that we talk about. The important thing is who we talk about it with.
And the people you work with that make the memories. Yeah.
And it's, you know what? And I get a buzz off of the listeners too. I mean, we have some really great guys out there that post stuff and that I feel a friendship with. And it's that relationship. The fact that we have music in common and we have gear in common, that's secondary.
We have to say here, and it is the period of the year when we all get emotional and say nice things. But really, Mike, you've kept this podcast going straight and on a really good target and helpful to everybody. You're the one that's kept this thing rolling, and you've done it for a very long time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. You guys are very kind.
Well, I had hair before I started.
So did I. Well, hey, listen, you know, it's great. It's all emotional, and I really appreciate all you guys and all the listeners out there. We really appreciate you, and we're looking forward to 2013 to doing some really cool things around the NAMM show and some other things that are coming down the pipe. And we just really appreciate the fact that you guys still listen to our podcast.
And happy Christmas to them all.
Yes. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays. Happy Hanukkah, the whole shebang. All right, guys. Well, hey, if you have any questions or comments or you just want to gush all over us like we're doing right now, you can reach us on our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/audionowcast. Or you can reach us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com. That's audio@nowcastnetwork.com. So from myself and all of the guys, we want to wish you happy holidays and a happy new year, and keep it in perspective, and we will see you next year.
Listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by API and West Wave Audio. The Audio Nowcast is hosted by Mike Rodriguez and uses AFEX's 230 Master Channel Voice Processor. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.